Okay, guys, so thanks everyone that's read and helped us open the meeting. I'd like to welcome those that have joined us since we first started. Massive welcome to any visitors to us tonight, and a huge welcome to any newcomers that might be in the room. We hope you're going to hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. So it falls on me tonight to introduce our speaker. I was trying to think when this person first appeared in our meetings, and I can't remember, which kind of tells me it's probably been a long time, over a period of many years, and they kind of always kind of seem to be there quietly, and in recent times more than in the past. And I have a huge amount of respect for this individual's recovery. I know they celebrated a fairly major milestone fairly recently. Always enjoy what they've got to say. So without any kind of further fanfare, I'm going to introduce you to Barbara, who's come along tonight to share her experience, strength and hope with us for 40 or 45 minutes, her journey to, into and through Narcotics Anonymous, for as long as she's comfortable with. So Barbara, the floor is yours. Please share with us and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Hi, my name's Barbara, and today I'm a recovering addict. And,
Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Barbara.
Hello.
Hello, gang, and just hello, everybody who's here. And, you know, welcome to anybody who's new to Highlands and Islands meetings tonight, and welcome to anybody who's just trying to find out what Narcotics Anonymous is. And you're welcome. You know, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using. So if you have used today, then you're still welcome. And hopefully what will happen here will help encourage you not to use again. And yes, so rather than going, oh yeah, I first came to Narcotics and to Highlands and Islands. I first started coming to these meetings when I lived abroad, and online meetings hadn't been going for very long. There were the UK NA online meetings and these ones, and I would go sometimes to the UK NA online ones. A person who started them was a good friend of mine and had told me about them, and then when I was living and working abroad one of the times in recovery, I've done that twice. I'm English and I live in England. So I live in England now, but I was working in Spain then. And so at the time, that friend and another friend of mine from home were hosting those meetings. And so it was really great to be abroad and to be in these online meetings. Then there was no Zoom or anything like that. All the meetings were audio only, but with people that I knew from home, it really made me feel connected to the fellowship. And then through that, or somehow, you know, I found out about these Skype then Highlands and Islands meetings, and the times of these meetings. They were the Monday and Wednesday lunchtime meetings, and so we're going then. And I would work it, because the job that I was doing in Spain was sort of in the afternoon and into the evening, and there was like a sort of hour's time difference anyway. So I'd catch a bus to where I was working, and I'd get into the building early, and I would use their computers to do the Highlands and Islands meetings at lunchtime. And then in the evening, I'd catch the bus back and I'd get back to the flat and I would do the UK NA online meetings. And so, you know, it started to sort of become like a thing, and in my life, and for, you know, and when I came back to England and I was in meetings, I would tell people about these meetings, and it was like, oh, no, what do you want to do online recovery for? And where I live, in my HQ is Cornwall, which is in the far west of Britain for anybody who isn't English and doesn't live in England. And it's, I mean, it's really pretty remote, like our Friday lunchtime home group in Penzance is like Britain's most westerly meeting, you know, which is something quite nice. And so I, and people would sort of say, oh, you know, this fellowship down here is so small and this, that and the other. It's nice to sort of go off to other places. So, well, why don't you try these online meetings, you know, and occasionally people did and they do. And then anyway, you know, we all know about lockdown and what happened, and suddenly online meetings, you know, became the only way to get recovery. And so I took to it very easily, you know, because for me it wasn't anything new. And so over the years, there's been times when I haven't been able to get to face-to-face meetings, or I've needed extra meetings, or I've needed English-speaking meetings, and I've come to Highlands and Islands, and I've always really enjoyed these meetings. And one of the things that I really love about coming to these meetings is that there's quite a few other people here who were still in, were in those meetings then. Just to sort of give it a bit of a time scale, it's 2013, so whatever year it is now, so that's 9 years. 9 years I've been coming to these meetings, and so for me, there's something about going to meetings where people keep coming back, you know, and they've been coming back for quite a long time. It's important to me. So the sort of anniversary that Steve referred to just now, and I almost can't believe it, it makes me feel like very quite emotional, you know, 25 years clean. It's like 25 bloody years. And somebody sent me a message saying, oh, it's your silver jubilee. And to me, it's like silver jubilee and silver hairs. And you know, I wasn't that young when I came into recovery. I was 36, you know, and like now I'm 61. And it's like, how did that happen? I thought I was going to die at 22, you know, in a hallucinogenic fueled motorbike accident. You know, that was my ambition, you know, even in my early 20s. You know, I found life so painful, I just wanted to die. And so there we are. I've been clean now longer than I used, and that's extraordinary. And so I started, I don't know, with these sort of shares, you know, I always sort of, because I'm always very sort of kind of present and current, and I'll kind of talk about the positive effects of recovery, or like my life today, and how I deal with it differently. Because I keep coming to the program, to me it is a daily program, and I've just kept coming back over all of those days. It's like a newcomer who keeps coming back because there's always something new. Anyway, you know, my clean date was March the 2nd in 1997, and so anyway, for the sake of identification, you know, I think it is quite good, you know, to sort of talk about one's background a bit, you know, because people do identify it sometimes. And I do find it helpful when I hear other people talking about that. Sometimes I can't identify at all. And then it's like, you know, look for the similarities and not the differences. And to me, the similarities are to do with the way people tend to think and the way their emotions manifest. And to me, it's like this sort of addict, dark and twisted sense of humour, you know, which I have learnt for me does not translate very well. You know, I sort of try my dark and twisted sense of humour away from other addicts, and people just think, people don't even find it funny. So whereas some addicts do. And so this is a gallows humour. And so I grew up in rural East Anglia and in the east of England. You know, and I was trying to think sort of how to kind of sort of bullet point it a bit. Anyway, my parents, neither of them were particularly young when they got married. And you know, then it was unusual, you know, like my mother was 36 and my father was 50. And my mother was a physiotherapist working in a hospital, and my father had a terrible car accident in which his wife and first child were killed. And I mean, it's awful, really, you know, look back. And anyway, my mother was treating him, and they fell in love, and they got married. And when I look back, having been in recovery some time now, you know, I look back and you know, I've sort of had various bits of outside help, and I do a lot of reading about emotional conditions and so on. Yeah, I look back and I can sort of see patterns, and I can sort of practice some forgiveness, you know, and just compassion. But for me, my father was a very cold, unattached man, you know, and I really didn't like him very much. Whereas now I can look upon him with extreme empathy. To me, that's a benefit of recovery, but I couldn't at the beginning, and I couldn't for a long time. And we grew up in my grandmother's house. She had a big house out in the countryside, and me and my brother and sister, I'm the eldest, grew up in this big house, which was amazing, really. But my grandmother was a total control freak and really quite a horrible person, but she brought me up. She was, my parents both went out to work, and my grandmother brought me up. You know, I can look back and see all sorts of, oh yeah, kind of attachment issues and this, that and the other, but we don't really talk about attachment issues in NA. But we can sometimes, people do share about how certain childhood pains, you know, they do see it as potentially being part of why they picked up drugs. So I don't know if that was why, but I can see certain patterns. There's definitely addiction to alcohol runs through our family in subtle and overt ways. And but I seem to be the only one who liked drugs. I know alcohol is a drug, but I seem to be the only one who went the path of narcotics. And so when I was a child, classic, and I'm still like it, you know, I was told, oh, don't touch that. And it was like, don't touch that bottle of pills or tablets, you know. It was like my mother's vitamin B when she was pregnant with my brother or something, who are iron pills. She said, don't touch those. What did I do? Touch them. I was quite a small child, took loads, threw up, right? You know, and it was like, well, hey, guess what I was doing in my teenage years? Taking pills that people told me I shouldn't take and throwing up, you know? And just things to do with the way I thought and behaved and things that I did. And I had a sort of inherent sense always that there wasn't enough, you know, I had to stash things and sometimes take things from other people that weren't mine. I mean, essentially stealing, I guess. I was always sort of quite covetous and quite secretive, and all of these things which manifest later on, you know, sort of behavior patterns of an addict. The disease of addiction. And so anyway, you know, there. And but overall, you know, I liked living in the countryside, you know, and I live in the countryside now. I find nature a very healing place, you know. I have a need for nature. And so yeah, I went to primary school and all that, and I was exceptionally bright. Very bright, much brighter, and also came from a family where everybody was very well read. They were very literary, and there was sort of people very well educated, and so it sort of rubbed off on all of us children. And growing up in a rural East Anglian village, you know, it was quite unusual. And so, you know, I excelled at primary school, which sort of kind of maybe put other demands on me. I don't know, but I never fitted. And I was picked on. And so anyway, then and I was the only one to sort of pass the 11 plus, you know, like the exam to go on to grammar education or whatever, the first person in that school for like 10 years or something. Anyway, so my parents sent me to boarding school, which is probably the worst thing. It was, from their point of view, it was a loving thing because they both went to boarding school, you know. And then so my parents, all our family went to boarding school, and they were all soldiers as well, you know, military army background, but also the older members of the family went through two world wars. So, you know, there were all these, there was quite a lot of anger and shouting and not a lot of empathy. And no room for feelings, very little room for feelings at all. And so anyway, so I was sent off to boarding school in, and I'm just going to say that because it's sort of like a kind of history lesson, you know, like in 1970, 71, you know, 11 years old. And the other girls there, you know, a lot of them, you know, they came from sort of privileged families, and a lot of them from army families. But and so they were all separated from their homes. And the older girls, the sort of 16, 17, 18 year olds, were all out taking acid. And they were all out taking acid and smuggling men into this boarding house. You know, I come from an incredibly sheltered background and was suddenly sort of, you know, learning about kind of sex, drugs and rock and roll at 11 years old in 1971. You know, the music was amazing. And I still like good music now. And but it was a hell of a sort of shock, and but it was a strong influence. And I was bullied extremely badly at that school. And one of the older girls took a lot of acid and acted out some extremely strange and very dark and weird sort of fantasies, you know, on me. You know, she tried to kill me at one point, you know, and it was like, And so it wasn't a very easy time. And, you know, and I wasn't supported through it anyway. You know, I think that really sent me off the rails. And I think it sent me off the rails very big style. And because I was exposed to drugs in this place and this drug culture and the drug world, a combination of extreme pain and mental torture and you know, and drugs, you know, sort of, to me the whole thing went as a package. And and so my teenage years were spent you know, going to posh schools. And anyway, my parents took me out of there after a couple of years, but I was very, very damaged by then. I was extremely messed up, you know, but I just got punished for being weird, you know. And so, you know, I'm kind of talking about these things in case, you know, there is identification, but you know, it's part of the story. And so anyway, this kind of proceeded, you know. I didn't have a nice teenage time at all. And by the time I was and experimenting with all sorts of drugs and behaviors and alcohol and so on. There's a lot of things you could buy over the counter then that you can't buy now, and for very good reason. And so, you know, taking all these over the counter, just walking to a chemist and buy all sorts of things and just take all these things. So consequently, I didn't do very well at school, whereas I could have done, you know, certainly got the brain for it, but I just didn't want to, you know, just turn up to exams stoned off my head. So anyway, you know, when I was 16, I got introduced to street drugs, and very, very quickly, you know, my addiction progressed very quickly and very fast. And so from the age of 16 to 36, I used street drugs, you know, but the addiction and using has sort of really started when I was at boarding school, when I was 11, and from there onwards. But once I was introduced to street drugs, you know, like a whole other story started to be written. And and the lifestyle, it got very dangerous very fast. And, you know, I walked in some extremely dark places with some extremely dark people and was lucky to get out of the lifestyle alive, let alone the use of the drugs. And but even back then, you know, even back then, I always had this feeling that there was something spiritual, there was something else. And I've heard it said that addiction is actually a form of spirituality. People who use drugs are quite often looking for some spiritual force, and we're trying to fill a hole inside of ourselves that is empty because it hasn't got a connection to basically some sort of higher love, I think. And anyway, in my early 20s, I came across a guru and a practice of meditation. And I said then to the, I went to an ashram to learn these meditation techniques, and I sort of fell in the door completely out of my trolley on opium. I literally fell in the door and sort of lay on the stairs, sort of going, oh, is this the right place to go to, kind of thing. And I mean, it was just nuts, but they were very nice to me. And anyway, I went through a process in sort of applying for these meditation techniques as such. And I remember saying to the person who was going to deliver them was like, I just really want something that I can do instead of picking up a drug. And they said, well, it doesn't work like that. And I thought, well, I really want something. I was 21. I really want something that works so I don't pick up a drug. And I didn't find it until I was 36. And all that time, you know, all that time I was looking for that thing that was going to stop me using drugs. You know, and it was a painful journey. And so anyway, fast forward, you know, I took drugs, you know, for 20 years. And then there came a point where I'd been with a guy for a few years, and meanwhile I'd had a child. And thank God, and that was one of the things that helped me stop using the hard drugs. And it gave me a reason to live. I didn't stop using any drugs at all, but I stopped using really toxic drugs. And it gave me a reason to live. And her dad died of this condition when she was 8. And she was 13 when I came into recovery, and she's going to be 38 in a minute. She's just now given me my first grandson. Epic. So thank goodness for that. And anyway, but so just a little time scale. And so anyway, I've been going out with this guy for a few years, having this sort of mental, like, using relationship. And you know, we were both nuts, not very good for each other at all, and just competitively used. And then one day he turned up, you know, he hadn't used drugs, and he said, I don't like you using drugs. And it was like, what? And anyway, he said, I've started going to Narcotics Anonymous. It's like, what? You know, like, what's that? And so anyway, he got clean, and he started to get well, you know, and he turned into a nice bloke instead of like this sort of crazy nutter. And and it came a point, and he said to me, I can't stay with you if you carry on using drugs. And it was like, oh. And by that time, you know, I had seen what was going on for him. I'd seen how it was changing him for the better. There was attraction going on. He gave me a copy of the basic text to look at. He showed me the steps. He showed me, he gave me one of the chapters to read. And I still don't know which chapter it was to today, you know, but anyway, I read one of the chapters, and maybe it was How It Works or something like that. And but I read through the steps, and I felt a very emotional response to them. And I just thought, if nothing, this is a nice way to live. It's a good way to live. And I knew, I did know that I was looking for another way to live. I knew that I had issues with anger, depression, you know, and like in, and one of the most powerful lines in the basic text, which I read when I was only a few weeks clean, was we were fighting fear, anger, guilt, depression, self-pity, anxiety, something like that. And I read that line and I thought, if being in Narcotics Anonymous and not using drugs means I can be free of those, that was, that they just haunted me. That was my whole reality, was fear, anger, depression, guilt, anxiety, you know. If I could change that, that would be worth anything. Because I just couldn't stand the way I was feeling. I couldn't stand it. And I was bored with the drugs and I could not stop them, you know. And I tried like for a month at a time and rah, rah, you know, I couldn't stay stopped. So I went to my first NA meeting in Penzance, you know, and then there was like two or three meetings a week in the whole of Cornwall and hardly any women. There certainly weren't any women in Penzance. My first 3 years of recovery was spent all with guys pretty much. And these women would drive from an hour away and come and see me. And one of them became my sponsor, offered to sponsor me. And I spent a lot of time kicking my ass. But she did get me through the first 9 steps in a very sort of random kind of way. But she did. And so anyway, I walked into this meeting and was given a good welcome. And I sat in this room with all these bonkers men, but they were talking about things. And I thought, God, they think the same way that I do, you know, and they obviously clearly all use drugs and a lot of drugs. And they're doing their absolute best they can to not use drugs. And they seem to be friends. You know, there was kind of something going on that I identified with. And I came out of that meeting with a sort of feeling of energy and a sort of, I felt energized and kind of light and I felt happy. And I thought, blimey, I like that feeling. And I didn't have to take a substance to get there, you know, blimey. And so I kept going back. But there's only one meeting a week, you know, but people, and I was a single parent. It wasn't so easy. Lived in the countryside, but people would ring me, you know, and do that good stuff, you know, do that fellowship stuff. And they looked after me. And it, so these men sort of kind of became like my brothers and uncles and fathers, you know, they gave me perhaps, you know, looking back, a sort of masculine influence that I didn't really know how to have a healthy relationship with, you know. So anyway, I kept coming back and I got clean through the rooms and I've stayed clean through the rooms, you know, and in the past few years through a lot of online recovery too. And I've never been to rehab and I've never been in an institution, thank God, only by the skin of my teeth, you know. But so like my place, you know, where I got clean and where I stay clean and I put down those drugs that I've been wanting to put down since I was 21 years old. At the age of 36, I was able to put them down and not pick them up again through Narcotics Anonymous. And, you know, so it's been a long story in the program, and all sorts of things have happened, all sorts of things, and I've done everything right and everything wrong, you know. And it says your wildest dreams come true, that has happened, and also my wildest nightmares, you know. And I've, thank God, you know, stayed clean through all of it. And you know, it's a long story, and so my first set of steps will work through the basic text and the little beige pamphlet, step four working guide. And so my first sponsor took me up to step 9 and then she moved away. And so I was sort of left on my own with kind of steps 10, 11 and 12. And that because of this meditation that I told you that I learned, you know, back long in the days in this funny little ashram, all those years, I'd actually continued to practice that on and off. And so I really started practicing in earnest when I came into recovery, and it really helped. And I still practice it today. Every day I practice that meditation, and it's a phenomenal thing. And so a combination of that and because of the online meetings and getting out to face-to-face meetings again, now I get a meeting pretty much every day, and sometimes more than one, sometimes several. And, you know, like, and at various times in my recovery, I thought, oh, I don't need to do this anymore. You know, I'm X amount of years clean, you know, da 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 da, you know, I must be fine by now. Boof, you know, that's when I have found out that I'm not. That's when I've found out how much more I still need to work the program. You know, this illness, the condition doesn't go away. You know, the program helps me become manageable. You know, step one is we're powerless over our addiction, but our lives are unmanageable. I'm still powerless over that today. And what I've learned is, you know, how powerful it is, you know, and it's a really, really horrible, horrible illness, you know, and I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy, you know. So I sort of feel, you know, that just to keep my head above water and kind of have a sort of smiling public face, you know, for anybody who's got this disease of addiction, you know, is a major achievement every single day. You know, because it, for me, it wants me on my own. It wants to torture me, drive me insane, and then kill me, you know, and that hasn't changed. And because I haven't fed it for a long time, you know, it gets cleverer and kind of gets more subtle and comes in around the edges, you know. And so the journey of recovery and the journey of understanding what it is that I live with, you know, is an extraordinary experience. And you know, I'll just take a couple of minutes to wind down now. And so anyway, but there was quite a lot of time where I didn't have a sponsor because I couldn't find one. And so sort of some co-sponsoring went on, or one thing and another. And, you know, I just kept going to meetings and reading the literature and whatnot. And when I was about 15 years clean, maybe 15, 16 years clean, something like that, maybe even 17 years clean. You know, the need for a sponsor and to actually be working the steps properly was such a strong need. And I was working away from home, and I was in a meeting in Devon. And I just said, does anybody know any women in this area, you know, who would sponsor me? And one of the guys said, yeah, I think we do. And so anyway, I was introduced to this lady who is 10 years younger than me, in physically in years, and I don't know, something like 15 years less time in the program. But the way she works her program is incredible, and the way she's been sponsored, you know, and so on. And she took me through the step working guide, which wasn't there when I first came into recovery, you know. And so in the past few years, I've worked that, and I've just completed sponsoring somebody through it. So I feel, blimey, you know, I've kind of earned my wings, you know. And it's a most extraordinary, extraordinary way of working the steps, you know. So while I've been in recovery, that book has appeared, and I've become familiar with it. The Living Clean has appeared, and I absolutely love that book, and it helps me so much. And and now The Guiding Principles has appeared, and I'm working the traditions with my sponsor through that book, and with some other ladies in Cornwall we're working through that book. And and I can't wait for the Spiritual Principles of the Day, you know, to actually be put into print. And what I really love, addicts are so clever, and they're just so ingenious, and, you know, will do anything, you know, they'll do absolutely anything to keep their addiction going, they'll do absolutely anything to keep their recovery going, you know. We haven't just had you know, one bit of literature that's been there for like a very, very, very long time and kind of one way of working a program. You know, we evolve our literature as we evolve and the fellowship evolves and the world evolves and, you know, it's a moving program. You know, the journey does continue, you know, and I hope that, you know, I continue to stay on it. You know, to me, it is one day at a time, but I have made a lifetime commitment so I can be there for the next generation of recovery and for the next generation in my own family. So anyway, I bless you all. You're such wonderful sort of like fellow travellers along the way. I feel a very strong spiritual connection with all the people who are in this meeting. So, you know, people go, oh, I love you all. I think, well, how can you? You know, you don't know these people, but I do feel a very loving, strong connection with everybody in this virtual room. And so thank you for letting me ramble on endlessly about me, which of course is my favorite topic and my favorite subject. So thank you very, very much. And I hope not too many of you fell asleep. All right. Bless you. Bless you. Thank you for letting me share.